The Federal News Update for Tuesday, November 4th, 2025. Welcome to The Deep Dive. I'm Alex Johnson.
And I'm Sam Kennedy.
We have really an unprecedented couple of days to break down for you. We're going to take an exhaustive look at what the U.S. federal government has been doing and maybe what it hasn't been doing over the last 48 hours. That's November 3rd and 4th, 2025.
Yeah, and it's crucial because this period, right before and during a major national election, it really throws things into sharp relief.
It really does. Our goal here is to get granular, to really dig into every major action from, well, all three branches. Because what we're seeing is this kind of fundamental fracture opening up in how government operates.
That fracture is definitely the headline finding from our sources. You know, you've got the executive branch in this frantic, almost desperate policy blitz trying to lock things down before the election results.
Right, trying to cement the legacy.
Exactly. But then, boom, on November 4th, the judicial branch pulls off what you could only call a strategic checkmate. It basically neutered a lot of that executive action almost instantly.
And hovering over all of this, we absolutely cannot forget, is the ongoing government shutdown. It's the grim backdrop to everything else.
A very long shutdown at this point.
So, yeah, it's a stunning mix. You've got these total divergent realities playing out simultaneously. We're going to start this deep dive where we almost have to with the crisis that's kind of underpinning all the political gamesmanship. That's the shutdown itself, the really critical fight over food benefits, and maybe surprisingly, a single moment where Congress actually agreed on something.
So let's set the stage, the shutdown. We're talking day 34 rolling into day 35.
We're deep into the sixth week now. That's getting close to record territory, isn't it?
It is. And you can really feel the mood across the country reflecting that sort of stagnation and frustration. Mm-hmm. Public polling, it's showing pretty widespread disapproval, something like 60% disapproval of how the current administration is handling the economy.
And it feels like more than just disapproval of one party or the other. The sources point to this really deep national anxiety. Almost half of Americans, 49%, now feel the country's best days are actually behind us.
Wow.
Yeah, that's a staggering number. It speaks volumes, I think, about just how this constant political dysfunction and, you know, economic uncertainty is hitting people psychologically.
And that anxiety, it's obviously magnified enormously for the federal workforce itself. The financial strain is becoming, well, frankly, unbearable for many.
We're hearing that agencies like Commerce, Justice, Homeland Security, NASA, GSA, these are big departments with critical functions. Yeah. They've officially told their folks that furloughs are being extended.
Right, extended out to late November, around the 29th or 30th, based on the notices.
Which means, realistically, for a lot of federal employees, they're looking at missing a third full paycheck in a row.
That's devastating.
It is. And we're seeing the ripple effects. Mm. Reports from lenders show a huge surge in loan applications from federal employees. These aren't low-skilled workers. These are often highly trained professionals.
Yeah, people with mortgages, car payments, kids.
Exactly. Certainly facing massive cash flow problems. Wow. They're turning to high-interest loans just to cover basic necessities like rent or groceries. And this stress, it's not just personal tragedy, right? It's a national mm-hmm. security risk. Mm-hmm. It's an economic drag, which we'll definitely circle back to.
And that human cost, it's maybe most visible and immediate in the whole SNAP benefits crisis. Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program.
Yeah, SNAP. Over 40 million Americans rely on this. Low-income families, seniors, people with disabilities. And those benefits, which usually hit their EBT cards right on the first of the month,
they just stopped, lapsed completely on November 1st because the funding wasn't there due to the shutdown.
The administration's initial stance was, well, that they didn't have the legal authority or maybe the contingency funds weren't sufficient to cover the costs.
Which immediately put the courts in the position of having to step in. We saw very fast judicial action on November 3rd, trying to force the issue.
Right. Almost simultaneous rulings. What happened there?
Well, you had a federal judge in Rhode Island issue a nationwide temporary restraining order, a TRO, basically ordering the administration to get those payments flowing again immediately.
Nationwide. That's significant.
Very. And at pretty much the same time, a U.S. district court in Massachusetts issued a similar order, specifically telling the USDA, the Department of Agriculture, to use whatever contingency funds or other resources it had available to make sure there wasn't a disruption in food aid.
So the courts basically said, no, you do have an obligation here. They created that legal requirement where the administration had claimed there wasn't one. What was the response from the administration under that kind of pressure?
Well, on that same day, November 3rd, the Trump administration announced they would move towards partial compliance. They said they'd tap into a USDA emergency contingency fund worth about $4.65 billion.
Okay, $4.65 billion sounds like a lot. Why partial? Why the controversy?
Because the total need for a full month of SNAP benefits is estimated somewhere between $8 billion and $9 billion. So that $4.65 billion, it only covers roughly half, maybe a little more, of what's actually needed for November.
So a huge shortfall remains.
Yeah.
What was the administration's justification for not covering the full amount?
Administration officials, including Patrick Penn, who oversees the program at USDA, argued, actually under sworn declaration in court, that the only other available pot of money large enough to cover the remaining $4 billion or so was something called the Section 32 Child Nutrition Fund.
Section 32. Okay, what is that exactly?
It's a pretty specific permanent appropriation fund. It goes way back to 1935. Its main jobs are to help stabilize farm income, often by buying up surplus commodities, and crucially, to support child nutrition programs. Think school lunches.
Ah, okay.
So the administration's lawyers argued that raiding that fund for general SNAP benefits would be an unacceptable risk. They claimed it could deplete the money needed for those specific school lunch and farm support programs, potentially causing another crisis down the line.
But congressional Democrats saw this completely differently, didn't they? In terms of the administration's authority.
Oh, absolutely. A totally opposite interpretation. Leaders like House Minority Leader Hakeem Jeffries, Congressman Jim McGovern, who chairs the Rules Committee and is big on nutrition issues, they were scathing. They called the partial funding deliberate, cruel, and basically non-compliant with what the courts intended.
What was their counter-argument on the funding authority?
Their core point was that the administration, mainly through the Office of Management and Budget, OMB, has broad, well-established authority to transfer funds between different USDA accounts in emergencies. They argued this power has been used in past shutdowns precisely to ensure SNAP benefits continued uninterrupted.
Right. They're saying the flexibility exists, the administration just chose not to use it fully.
Exactly. McGovern, in particular, drew a really sharp contrast. He pointed out, rhetorically, that the administration had apparently found tens of billions for things like international bailouts in recent memory, but suddenly couldn't find $4 billion to, as he put it, feed 40 million Americans.
That definitely frames it as a political choice, not a legal necessity.
It shifts the narrative powerfully from legal constraints to, well, alleged political cruelty. Meanwhile, you had House Speaker Mike Johnson defending the administration, and he actually called the lawsuits that forced even the partial payment frivolous.
So complete partisan division on this. What's the practical impact of this partial funding and the delay?
Immediate hardship, pure and simple. Even with the partial funds okayed, state officials like the California Attorney General warned it would take at least a week, maybe much longer, in states with older systems, just to process those partial benefits and get them onto people's EBT cards.
So the court ordered action, but the way the administration complied still guarantees delays for families who are already desperate.
That's the reality on the ground. It really highlights the human cost of this political gridlock.
It really does. And this intense fighting, this paralysis, it makes what happened next in Congress even more, well, notable. Amidst all this bitterness, they actually managed to pass one single, very strategic piece of legislation together.
Yeah, it's quite the contrast. On November 3rd, Congress passed, and the president actually signed, Public Law 119-284. It's called the Short-Term Funding Stability Act. And what it is, essentially, is a clean continuing resolution, or CR.
Okay, for folks maybe less steeped in the DC jargon, a clean CR that feels rare these days.
Yeah.
What does clean mean here, and what was the strategy behind it?
Clean means it basically just continues funding the government at the current levels without loading it up with controversial extras. No partisan policy writers, no demands for specific spending cuts or increases that only one side wants, none of what they call poison pills.
Right. Just keeps the lights on, so to speak.
Exactly. And this specific CR funds the government through February 1st, 2026. The strategy behind passing it now, right before the election, it was described in some analyses as a kind of collusive act of de-escalation.
De-escalation, meaning?
Meaning leadership in both parties, in both the House and Senate, worked together to take the immediate threat of the shutdown and all the political blame that comes with it off the table right before people went to vote.
Ah, okay. So it stabilizes things, removes a campaign issue.
Precisely. It provides some market stability, ensures federal operations don't completely cease right during an election, and crucially, it pushes the real fight, the hard decisions about fiscal year 2026 appropriations, the actual budget numbers and policy changes well into the new year, probably after the new Congress is seated, maybe even under a new administration.
So they cooperated to manage the immediate political risk, but they didn't actually solve any of the underlying disagreements that caused the shutdown in the first place.
Not at all. It achieves stability for political maneuvering, but zero progress on the core fiscal and policy disputes.
Which kind of explains that weird dynamic we saw, right? Where Congress passes this clean CR, but then, like, House GOP leaders immediately shoot down former President Trump's call to, say, get rid of the Senate filibuster to end the shutdown faster.
It fits perfectly. They can find common ground on the absolute bare minimum keeping the government technically funded, but they remain completely deadlocked and strategically paralyzed on almost everything else. The legislative branch is sort of splitting itself, doing the bare minimum required fiscal duty while maximizing its preferred role, which is partisan messaging.
Well, speaking of messaging and maybe last-ditch efforts, that leads us perfectly into the flurry of activity we saw from the executive branch really kicking off on November 3rd. Let's shift gears to that. What we're calling the executive sprint. These look like moves designed to build a policy legacy, but as the sources make clear, they were maybe built on legal foundations that were already starting to crumble.
Yeah, the phrase midnight regulations really fits here. These are rules finalized right at the end of an administration's term, or just before a big political moment like an election. The goal is usually to make them permanent before a potential successor can easily undo them.
But these particular rules, launched in early November 2025, were flying straight into a brand new and much harsher legal headwind.
Exactly, a headwind they likely didn't fully anticipate.
Let's start with the big one on the environmental front.
Yeah.
The EPA's final rule on PFAS in drinking water. That was announced November 3rd.
This was genuinely a landmark policy goal for environmental health advocates. PFAS, per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances, you know, the so-called forever chemicals.
Right, they're everywhere and linked to some serious health problems.
They are. And this EPA rule sets the first ever national standards for several specific PFAS chemicals in public drinking water systems across the country. It's incredibly sweeping. We're talking about compliance cost monitoring, new filtration systems, infrastructure upgrades, estimated in the tens of billions of dollars for water utilities over the next decade or so.
Tens of billions. That is definitely the kind of major legacy-defining policy an administration would want to lock in, forcing future governments to deal with the rollout and the price tag.
Absolutely. And you saw similar ambition over at HHS, the Department of Health and Human Services.
Mm-hmm.
On November 4th, they finalized a major rule specifically dealing with AI and medical devices.
AI in healthcare, that's obviously a huge and rapidly growing field. What was the goal of this HHS rule?
It's really aimed at the future of medicine, trying to ensure transparency, safety, and accountability for all these new AI-driven diagnostic tools, imaging analysis software, even robotic surgical assistants.
Makes sense. What kind of requirements does it impose on the companies developing this tech, the med tech sector?
Pretty significant new hurdles, honestly. The rule demands extensive documentation about the data used to train the AI models. It requires clear explanations of how the algorithms actually make decisions, trying to get away from the black box problem.
Right, where even the developers don't fully understand why it reached a certain conclusion.
Exactly. And it mandates processes for ongoing monitoring and updating of these AI models after they're deployed in hospitals or clinics. The idea is to catch biases or performance drifts before they cause harm, especially when patient lives are on the line.
So, okay, EPA rule. Billions in costs, nationwide impact, HHS rule, massive new regulatory framework for a cutting-edge multi-trillion dollar industry. These seem like precisely the kind of major regulations the administration wanted to push through.
They absolutely are. Prime examples of using executive authority to shape policy for decades.
But here's where, as you said, the story takes a turn. Our analysis, based on what happened next, suggests both of these massive rules were essentially dead on arrival.
That's the stark assessment, yeah. They were launched based on the old playbook, the assumption that agencies have significant leeway, significant deference from the courts to interpret older, sometimes vaguely written laws passed by Congress decades ago.
The old Chevron doctrine world.
Precisely. But as we're about to discuss in detail, the Supreme Court effectively tore up that playbook on November 4th, literally hours after the HHS AI rule was finalized.
And you're seeing there were immediate consequences for that HHS rule.
Immediate. We have confirmation that the HHS rule, which clearly has vast economic significance, was challenged immediately. And critically, the Fifth Circuit Court of Appeals enjoined it, put it on hold on that same day, November 4th, and they explicitly cited the new judicial standards set by the Supreme Court just hours earlier.
Wow. So the executive branch was sprinting full speed ahead on a road that the judicial branch had essentially just vaporized underneath them.
That's a perfect metaphor for it. Utterly disconnected realities.
Okay, beyond these huge, potentially doomed regulations, the executive branch was also busy with more targeted actions. Things that look less like long-term policy and more like, well, political signaling right before the election.
Absolutely. The timing on some of these is almost impossible to ignore from a political perspective. Take the Department of Justice antitrust lawsuit filed on November 3rd against a company called Titan AgriCorp.
Okay, what was the allegation?
The DOJ alleged anti-competitive practices and market manipulation in the food supply chain. But crucially, the press release and the filings explicitly linked Titan AgriCorp's alleged behavior to inflated consumer food prices.
Right. Inflation being maybe the number one issue for voters heading into the polls on the 4th. That timing doesn't feel accidental.
Not at all. It looks like pure 11th-hour campaign messaging. The strategic goal seems pretty clear. Generate news headlines that pin the blame for high grocery bills on corporate greed rather than, say, government spending or monetary policy.
So it allows the administration to look like it's actively fighting inflation, right, when voters are paying attention, regardless of how long the lawsuit actually takes or its ultimate chance of success.
Precisely. The lawsuit itself alleges some specific things, discriminatory pricing against smaller producers, using restrictive shipping contracts to block competitors. It'll take years to litigate fully, but the filing itself serves that immediate political purpose. It also signals a more aggressive antitrust stance that might persist, but the timing is key here.
We also saw some action from the Treasury Department, specifically the Office of Foreign Assets Control, OFAC, targeting the crypto world.
Yeah, on November 3rd, OFAC announced sanctions against three crypto exchanges based in a place called Nornum. The justification was that these exchanges were being used for illicit finance, money laundering, sanctions evasion, that sort of thing, using digital assets to get around U.S. financial controls.
What's the signal being sent there right before an election?
It reads as a pre-election show of toughness, specifically on illicit finance and maybe indirectly on the crypto industry itself, which faces ongoing regulatory uncertainty.
And what's the broader message to the digital asset industry globally?
It's a pretty stark warning. OFAC's reach is long, and the rules apply even in the decentralized digital world. Just because an exchange isn't based in the U.S. doesn't mean it's immune if it's facilitating transactions that touch the U.S. financial system or involve U.S. persons or sanctioned entities.
So it forces these exchanges further away from the U.S. market.
It certainly tries to. The immediate impact is likely market disruption for those specific exchanges and a clear signal to others about the risks of non-compliance with U.S. sanctions regimes. It reinforces OFAC's power.
Okay, and then the Department of Transportation, DOT, got in on the action too, also on November 3rd, with something about drones.
Yeah, they published what's called a Notice of Proposed Rulemaking, an NPRM. This one is focused on setting up the rules of the road for low-altitude commercial drone operations, specifically creating drone corridors in urban areas.
Ah, so this is about enabling things like large-scale drone delivery from companies like Amazon or UPS or Google's Wing.
Exactly. It's trying to create the regulatory certainty needed for those companies to invest billions in building out those networks. So in that sense, it's a huge buy signal to the drone logistics industry saying, we're building the framework for you.
What? Given the scale and the economic impact, I'm guessing this proposed rule, if finalized, would also run straight into the buzzsaw of the new legal standard we mentioned.
Almost certainly. Establishing a whole new multi-billion dollar economic regime like designated drone corridors based largely on interpreting existing aviation safety laws passed decades ago, that seems like a prime candidate to fail the explicit congressional authorization test under the new standard.
So another example of the executive planning for a future based on old rules, while the judiciary is busy changing those rules.
It really highlights the disconnect. Investing time and resources in developing these complex rules, only to have the courts potentially freeze them years later, demanding Congress pass brand new, specific legislation, which we know is incredibly difficult.
Let's shift to national security actions. The White House put out an executive order on November 3rd about AI, but focused specifically on security.
Right. This EO is very targeted. It directs DHS, Homeland Security, and the DOD, the Defense Department, to basically fast-track the buying and deploying of AI systems. specifically for two things: border security and defending critical infrastructure.
So, showing action on border control and national security modernization, both likely voter priorities.
Seems likely. But this EO creates a really interesting and potentially problematic policy contradiction within the administration's own approach to AI.
How so?
Well, remember that HHS rule we just talked about? That was all about heavily regulating civilian AI use in medicine, demanding transparency, safety checks, accountability.
Why standards for the private sector?
But this EO, focused on the government's own use of AI for security, prioritizes the speed of deployment. It effectively creates a kind of sovereign sector exemption. The government seems to be holding itself and its defense contractors to a potentially looser standard regarding algorithmic transparency and oversight than it's demanding from, say, hospitals using AI.
That seems like a recipe for future controversy, doesn't it?
No.
Issues around surveillance, civil liberties, bias in AI used for border screening or threat detection.
Absolutely. This dual-track approach, regulate civilian AI tightly, fast-track government security AI, is going to fuel major legal and ethical debates for years to come. How much transparency is required when the government uses AI against its own citizens or at its borders? This EO kicks that can down the road.
We also saw more developments related to that controversial policy of using military personnel in domestic law enforcement roles, specifically around immigration. Defense Secretary Pete Hegseth provided some details.
Yes, there was follow-up on the plan announced back in September to detail military lawyers, up to 600 of them, to the Department of Justice, their role, to serve as Special Assistant U.S. Attorneys, or SARSAs, focused primarily on immigration enforcement cases.
And there was also news about immigration judges.
Correct. A related DOJ notice named 11 new permanent immigration judges and 25 temporary judges. The notable thing is the background. Sources indicate most have military ties, and critically, at least 18 of them are apparently still serving in the military reserves, Army, Navy, Marine Corps.
Okay, let's unpack this because it's legally complex. Using military lawyers as SAOSIS, basically, as federal prosecutors, has some precedent, right? Mm. Particularly for crimes on military bases.
There is some limited precedent, yes. Usually related to the military justice system or crimes occurring on federal installations where there's a clear nexus to military jurisdiction.
But using currently serving military personnel, even lawyers, as adjudicators, acting like judges in civilian immigration courts, that feels different. That's where the main controversy lies.
That's the crux of it, and the distinction is really important. A SAOSA, even if in uniform, is acting as a prosecutor within the executive branch's law enforcement function. But an immigration judge, even in an administrative court system, is acting in a quasi-judicial role, making decisions about detention, removal, asylum claims decisions with profound consequences for individuals.
So having someone who is simultaneously under military command making those decisions about civilians raises fundamental questions.
It raises huge questions. Legal scholars are pointing to potential conflicts with the Posse Comitatus Act, which generally prohibits the use of the military for domestic law enforcement. And there are major due process concerns. Can someone subject to military discipline and chain of command truly be an impartial adjudicator in a civilian proceeding? Does it blur the lines between the military's role to execute policy and defend and the judiciary's role to interpret law and adjudicate disputes?
It seems like a major test of those boundaries, potentially using national security arguments to justify military involvement in what has traditionally been a civilian administrative law function.
It's definitely pushing those boundaries, and the lack of clear, specific statutory authority for using active duty personnel as immigration judges is the central legal vulnerability being highlighted.
Okay, shifting from personnel to hardware and supply chains, there was a significant financial commitment announced related to rare earth magnets.
Yes, also on November 3rd, the administration committed nearly $750 million to boost domestic U.S. production of a specific type, neodymium iron boron magnets.
Neodymium. Okay. Why are these specific magnets so important that the government is putting $750 million into making them here?
Because they are absolutely critical for a ton of modern technology, especially high-performance applications. Think powerful electric motors and EVs and wind turbines, precision guidance systems and missiles, advanced radar and sonar systems, even components and things like the F-35 fighter jet.
So defense applications are a major driver here.
A huge driver. And the strategic vulnerability this stark. Currently, China overwhelmingly dominates the global supply chain for processing the rare earth elements needed and manufacturing these high-strength magnets. We're talking well over 90% control of certain key stages.
That's obviously a massive dependency for critical defense systems.
An unacceptable dependency from the administration's perspective. So this investment, it's a partnership involving the DOD's Office of Strategic Capital, the Commerce Department, and two private companies, Vulcan Elements and ReElement Technologies, is a direct effort to build a secure domestic alternative.
And the structure of the deal is interesting too, right? The government isn't just giving grants, it's taking stock warrants.
That's right. The Defense Department is providing the bulk of the funding, a $620 million loan commitment, but it's also receiving stock warrants in both companies. That means the government gets the right to buy shares in these companies at a set price later on.
So the government becomes directly invested in their success. It's industrial policy explicitly aimed at national security.
Exactly. It's a clear move to de-risk the supply chain for critical military hardware by ensuring production happens domestically, or at least among trusted allies. It acknowledges that relying on a strategic competitor for these fundamental building blocks is just too risky. It's part of a broader push to reshore critical manufacturing.
Okay, so we've covered regulations, political signaling, national security moves. Before we get to the judicial earthquake, there were a couple of other executive actions designed specifically to be, well, sticky, hard for a future administration to easily undo.
Right. Actions aimed at creating durable administrative policy. First, there was a memo from the Office of Personnel Management, OPM, on November 3rd regarding telework for the federal workforce.
Telework, okay. What did the memo do?
It essentially formally codified and expanded the flexible telework policies that became widespread during and after the pandemic, making them the default posture for many eligible federal employees.
Now that might sound just administrative, like internal HR policy. Why is this seen as a strategic, durable move? Couldn't a new president just issue another memo saying everyone back to the office?
Not so easily, and that's the key. By formally codifying this expanded telework posture through OPM, the administration forces any successor who wants a mass return to office to go through a much more difficult, time-consuming, and legally fraught process.
Meaning they couldn't just issue a quick directive.
Likely not. They'd probably have to engage in formal rulemaking under the Administrative Procedure Act. That means publishing a proposed rule, opening it up for public comment, which would likely be overwhelmingly negative from employees and unions, analyzing those comments, providing detailed legal justification for the change, and likely facing lawsuits challenging the reversal.
So it turns a simple policy reversal into a major bureaucratic and legal battle.
Exactly. It effectively locks in widespread remote work as the status quo. This is undoubtedly good for recruitment and retention in the federal workforce, a key priority for many employees. But it also has significant downstream consequences.
Like the impact on Washington, D.C.'s economy.
Precisely. It reinforces the ongoing negative impact on D.C.'s commercial real estate market. High office vacancy rates, struggling downtown businesses, depressed city tax revenues. This OPM memo helps solidify those trends as a longer-term structural reality, not just a temporary pandemic effect.
Interesting. Okay, and the other durable action was on the foreign policy front, something from the State Department about the Arctic.
Yes, also November 3rd. The State Department issued what's called a diplomatic note. This one proposes a new multilateral framework for the Arctic region focused on sustainable resource management and demilitarization.
Primarily aimed at
Russia and China, who have both been increasing their military and economic activity in the Arctic as the ice melts and new shipping routes and resources become accessible. The U.S. note tries to frame the issue around international cooperation, environmental protection, and keeping the region peaceful.
Is this seen as a genuine attempt to start negotiations, or is it more strategic positioning?
It's likely more strategic positioning than a realistic short-term negotiation plan. The goals seem to be threefold. One, establish a high watermark for U.S. policy aspirations in the Arctic. Set the terms of the debate. Two, reframe the discussion away from pure great power competition and resource grabs towards a more values-based approach invoking international law and environmental concerns.
And third,
critically, it tries to diplomatically box in any successor administration. By putting this proposal out there, the U.S. pressures allies, think Canada, Norway, other Arctic nations, to align with this framework. That makes it politically harder, both at home and with allies, for a future administration to just abandon this approach and adopt a purely unilateral or confrontational stance in the Arctic. It raises the diplomatic cost of reversal.
So another move designed to constrain future policy options using international diplomacy this time.
Exactly. Setting a baseline that's difficult to walk back from easily.
Okay. It's clear the executive branch was incredibly busy, firing off policies left and right, presumably operating under the assumption that these actions would shape the landscape for years to come.
A furious pace, clearly trying to get as much done as possible.
But that brings us inevitably to the massive event of November 4th, Section 3, the judicial checkmate. This is the moment where everything changed, where the Supreme Court essentially rewrote the rules of governance.
Yeah, November 4th, 2025. Legal scholars are already saying this date will be remembered as a kind of constitutional turning point, not driven by an election or legislation, but by a decision from the appointed judiciary. The key case is a 5-4 opinion called Clough v. Department of the Interior.
Clough v. Interior. We really need to spend some time unpacking this one. What exactly did the Clough ruling do, and why are people calling it revolutionary?
Okay, so Clough fundamentally changed how courts review major actions taken by federal agencies. It did this by significantly clarifying and strengthening something called the Major Questions Doctrine, or MQD.
Major Questions Doctrine. Okay.
To grasp why MQD becoming dominant is so revolutionary, you have to understand the doctrine it effectively replaced as the default, the Chevron Doctrine. For about 40 years, Chevron deference was the rule.
And
Chevron basically said that if a law passed by Congress was ambiguous or silent on a specific issue, courts should defer to the interpretation made by the expert agency responsible for administering that law, as long as the agency's interpretation was reasonable.
So it gave agencies a lot of power to fill in the details, to adapt old laws to new problems.
Immense power. It was the legal foundation for much of the modern regulatory state. Agencies could issue significant rules on everything from environmental protection to financial regulation based on relatively broad mandates from Congress passed decades ago.
Okay, so that was the old world under Chevron. What does the new world look like under Clough and the Strength in Major Questions Doctrine?
Clough flips the script entirely. It essentially throws out that idea of deference on big issues. Instead, it establishes a much stricter standard, presumptive invalidity.
Presumptive invalidity, meaning the default assumption is that a major rule is not valid.
Exactly. Any agency rule that addresses a major question, defined generally as having vast economic and political significance, is presumed invalid unless, and this is the crucial part, unless the agency can point to explicitly clear and unmistakable authorization for that specific type of regulation directly from Congress in the text of a law.
Wow. So no more interpreting vague language in old laws to justify major new policies. Congress has to have clearly, specifically, undeniably authorize that exact kind of action.
That's the new standard. The agency can't just find ambiguity and fill it. It needs a clear statement from Congress. It dramatically shifts power away from the agencies, away from the executive branch.
Where does that power shift to?
Primarily, it shifts power back to Congress to legislate with specificity if it wants major new policies. But since Congress is often gridlocked and finds it incredibly difficult to pass major specific legislation,
it effectively paralyzes the ability to create major new policy through regulation.
That's the practical impact, yes. It creates a massive barrier to significant new federal regulation on any issue where Congress hasn't already spoken with extreme clarity. Think climate change, AI, cybersecurity standards, financial innovation, areas where technology and challenges evolve much faster than Congress legislates. The executive branch's hands are now tied from acting decisively in these areas using existing laws.
So unless Congress somehow overcomes its deep divisions and passes highly specific new laws, major federal policymaking through regulation basically grinds to a halt.
That's the chilling effect. And the power to decide whether Congress was clear enough or whether a rule addresses a major question, that power now resides squarely with the judiciary, particularly the Supreme Court. They become the ultimate arbiters of almost all significant federal action. Clough is essentially a new legal super weapon for challenging agency rules.
And the court didn't wait long to show how it intended to use this new weapon, did it? They immediately signaled a specific target.
They did, with almost surgical precision. On the very same day they released the Clough opinion, November 4th, The court also announced it was granting a writ of certiorari, meaning agreeing to hear the case in Texas v. EPA.
Texas v. EPA. And that case challenges.
It challenges the brand new EPA rule on PFAS in drinking water, the same rule finalized just the day before on November 3rd.
The timing is just incredible. Granting review of a rule less than 24 hours old on the same day they announced the new standard that seems tailor-made to strike it down.
It's about as clear a signal as the court can send. The EPA PFAS rule is almost a perfect test case for the new CLOUS standard.
Why is it such a good fit?
Well, first, does it involve a major question with vast economic and political significance? Absolutely. Tens of billions in costs affecting nearly every public water system, addressing a major public health concern, it clearly qualifies.
Okay.
Second, did the EPA rely on explicit, unmistakable authorization from Congress specifically for regulating these particular PFAS chemicals at these levels? Almost certainly not. They relied on general authorities in the Safe Drinking Water Act, which was passed long before PFAS were widely understood as contaminants. There's no specific mention of PFAS in the authorizing statute.
So it fails the new CLOUT test.
It appears custom-built to fail the CLOUT test. By granting cert immediately, the court is essentially putting the EPA rule on notice, publicly signaling its likely demise under the newly announced doctrine. It's like painting a target on it.
This really underscores a very deliberate, coordinated judicial strategy.
Mm.
But the court also made another move that day, one that showed they aren't necessarily against all agency action, right?
He highlighted a distinction.
Yes, and that contrast is vital for understanding the new landscape. Also, on November 4th, in its list of orders, the Supreme Court denied certiorari in a case called Quantum Leap v. SEC.
Denied cert, meaning they let the lower court's decision stand.
Exactly. They refused to hear the appeal, and that lower court ruling had affirmed an enforcement action taken by the Securities and Exchange Commission, the SEC.
What was the SEC going after Quantum Leap for?
The SEC had penalized Quantum Leap for making misleading claims about its AI capabilities, essentially what people are now calling AI washing.
Hyping up their AI tech to investors beyond what was real. Precisely. The SEC argued this constituted securities fraud under existing laws, specifically the Securities Act of 1933 and the Exchange Act of 1934, which clearly prohibit making false or misleading statements to investors.
And the courts upheld the SEC's action and a significant fine.
Yes, the lower courts upheld the SEC's authority and what was reportedly a record-setting fine for this type of AI washing case. The Supreme Court's denial lets that precedent stand.
So why is this denial important when viewed alongside CLOW and the EPA case? What's the distinction the court seems to be drawing?
It shows the court using a scalpel, not a sledgehammer. They are striking down new major policy rules that agencies create based on broad interpretations of old laws where Congress wasn't explicit, like the EPA PFAS rule and likely the HHS AI rule. That's the CLOW effect, gutting agency policymaking power.
Right.
But they are upholding the agency's traditional power to enforce existing clear laws passed by Congress. The SEC wasn't creating a new policy regime. It was policing fraud under statutes that have been on the books for nearly a century.
So agencies can still investigate and punish companies for breaking existing clear laws, but they can't use those same laws to create sweeping new regulatory requirements for entire industries.
That seems to be the crucial distinction. Traditional enforcement under clear statutory mandates is okay. Broad new regulation based on vague mandates is not. Especially if it's economically significant. Regulation is out, enforcement is in, at least major new regulation.
This judicial checkmate, as you called it, it really does change the entire game in Washington. But while these huge structural shifts are happening at the Supreme Court level, the day-to-day reality of the government shutdown continues to bite, affecting the federal workforce and potentially national security. Let's pivot back to that Section 4, the workforce and national security under strain.
Yeah, the impact there is immediate and potentially dangerous. A central point from the sources is about cybersecurity. That's a function that simply cannot be paused.
Right. Attackers don't take holidays or respect government shutdowns.
Exactly. And they are sophisticated. They know precisely when defenses might be down, when personnel are distracted or absent. We have reports confirming that significant numbers of federal cybersecurity personnel are furloughed. That includes, worryingly, more than half the staff at CISA, the Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency.
CISA is the lead agency for protecting federal networks and critical infrastructure. If half their staff is out,
it means critical functions slow down or stop. patching known vulnerabilities gets delayed. Monitoring for threats is reduced. Responding to incidents takes longer. The capacity for proactive cyber defense is significantly degraded right when it might be needed most.
And the risk isn't just about fewer people watching the monitors, is it? The shutdown itself creates new vulnerabilities.
It absolutely does, particularly around insider risk. Think about it. You have thousands of federal employees, many with high-level security clearances, under immense financial stress. They're anxious about missing paychecks, worried about their families, maybe feeling devalued by the government they serve.
Which makes them potential targets.
Potentially, yes. Both those furloughed at home and those deemed essential but forced to work without pay. Foreign intelligence services or other malicious actors know this is a prime time to try and recruit sources or perhaps coerce someone facing financial ruin into providing information or access they wouldn't normally consider giving up.
So the focus shifts from just technical defenses to the human element. The well-being of the workforce itself becomes a security issue.
It's intrinsically linked. Yeah. And you mentioned the administration fast-tracking AI for defense earlier. While AI and automation can handle some routine monitoring, they can't replace human judgment.
Right. You need the expert analyst to interpret the data, to spot the subtle anomaly, to provide the checks and balances on automated systems.
And if that expert analyst is furloughed or working under extreme duress and maybe not fully focused, the danger is that adversaries could be conducting quiet reconnaissance now, mapping systems, implanting dormant malware, harvesting data, things that don't trigger immediate alarms but could enable devastating attacks later on, perhaps targeting critical infrastructure like water systems or the power grid years after the shutdown ends. The vulnerability created now can have very long-term consequences.
That's a chilling thought. And the economic stress isn't just internal, it's spilling out into the broader job market, especially in areas heavily reliant on the federal government.
Absolutely. The DC metro area job market in particular is reportedly flooded right now. You've got a huge influx of resumes from highly qualified federal employees and government contractors who have either lost their jobs due to the shutdown and related contract freezes, or they're just preemptively looking for more stable employment outside the federal ecosystem.
We saw some specific numbers, right? Like Maryland losing thousands of federal jobs recently.
Yeah, one source mentioned Maryland losing something like 15,100 federal jobs just since January 2025. That's a massive hit to a regional economy, and it creates this incredibly competitive environment for those seeking work.
We heard anecdotes of people sending out hundreds of applications with very little response. How is this intense competition changing the job search itself for these often highly specialized federal workers?
It's forcing them to adapt quickly, often painfully. Because of the sheer volume of applicants, many private sector companies are relying heavily on automated application tracking systems, ATS software, to do the initial screening.
The AI gatekeepers.
Pretty much. And these systems are often programmed to look for specific keywords, metrics, and formats common in corporate resumes. Federal employees who are used to the very detailed, often acronym-laden, duty-focused format of the standard federal resume used on USA Joe BS.
They get filtered out.
They often get automatically rejected by the ATS before a human even sees their application. They need to learn to translate their government experience, which might say manage program X, into the language of private industry. Things like achieved Y percent cost savings or led a team of Z to deliver project Q ahead of schedule. They have to quantify their accomplishments and use industry standard keywords, essentially learning a whole new way to present their skills. Or the AI just screens them out.
That's a tough transition on top of the financial stress. And this atmosphere of crisis and uncertainty is even impacting basic civic participation, isn't it? We're seeing reports about federal employees facing new hurdles just trying to vote in the current elections.
Yeah, this is really concerning. It seems to be creating this inconsistent agency-by-agency mess regarding administrative leave for voting. OPM, the personnel agency, had issued guidance earlier in the year that generally allowed federal employees up to 3 hours of paid administrative leave to vote, specifically if their work schedule didn't provide a reasonable opportunity to vote outside of work hours.
Okay, that seems like a standard practice. What's changing now?
Now, during the shutdown or right before the election, some agencies are actively tightening those rules, making it harder for their employees, especially essential ones working long shifts, to get time off to vote.
Can you give some specific examples?
Sure. The EPA, for instance, reportedly sent out a memo saying employees are generally not entitled to admin leave for voting if they have enough time before or after their shift. And even if they don't, the maximum leave they might get is just 1 hour, and only if there's absolutely no other way they could reasonably vote. That's a significant tightening compared to the general OPM guidance.
1 hour maximum, only if absolutely necessary.
And some agencies went even further.
Apparently so. The General Services Administration, GSA, reportedly told its employees that admin leave for voting just wasn't permitted anymore. They'd have to use their own leave time, like annual leave, or vote entirely on their own time.
Wow. And the Forest Service. The Forest Service guidance was reportedly even more restrictive. Employees were told they were simply not authorized to use administrative leave to vote or participate in voting-related activities, seemingly without exception.
That seems highly problematic, especially for essential employees who might be working 12-hour shifts without pay during the shutdown. It creates a real barrier to exercising a fundamental right.
It really does. It creates this uneven playing field where a public servant's ability to vote easily might depend entirely on which agency they happen to work for. It seems contrary to the spirit of encouraging civic participation, especially among the government's own workforce.
Okay, one last critical item related to the workforce under strain. We need to touch on the Federal Employee Health Benefits Program, FEHB. The annual open season for choosing plans is happening right in the middle of all this chaos.
Yeah, the timing is terrible. FEHB open season is scheduled to start November 10th, and it's a particularly crucial one this year because average premiums are jumping significantly. The figure cited is about 12.3%.
Ouch. A 12.3% average increase when people are already missing paychecks. That puts enormous pressure on federal employees and retirees to shop carefully for their 2026 health plans.
It really does. They need to scrutinize the options, compare costs, check provider networks, look at prescription drug coverage. But the unfortunate reality is, historically, most don't.
What's the statistic on that, the inertia factor?
It's incredibly high. Estimates suggest that around 95% of federal workers and retirees typically do nothing during open season. They just let their current plan roll over year after year.
Which can be a really costly mistake, right?
A huge mistake. People's health needs change over time. Maybe they develop a new condition. Maybe their kids age off the plan. Maybe they need different specialists. Plus, the plans themselves change networks, shift, formularies are updated, new benefits might be added, or, as we say this year, premiums can skyrocket. Mm-hmm. Simply doing nothing is often the worst financial strategy. Everyone should really be using the online comparison tools OPM provides.
Beyond the big premium hike, are there any other specific notable changes in the FEHB plans for 2026 that people should be aware of? Things highlighted in the plan brochures or OPM guidance?
There are a couple of really specific changes mentioned in the sources that reflect current health trends and, frankly, political winds. First, OPM apparently directed health plans to increase coverage for a specific class of weight loss medications. The GLP-1 agonists.
Drugs like Ozempic, Wegovy, Mounjaro, the ones that have become incredibly popular and effective for weight loss and diabetes management.
Exactly. Recognizing their clinical value, OPM is pushing for broader coverage, which is potentially a major benefit expansion for many federal employees struggling with obesity or related conditions.
Okay, that's one significant change. What's the other?
The other is sort of the flip side, reflecting the current political climate. Sources indicate that coverage for certain gender-affirming surgeries or related procedures has been removed or restricted in the 2026 plan guidance.
Removed or restricted? Why?
The OPM rationale cited was basically the prevailing political atmosphere and ongoing legal challenges surrounding coverage mandates for these types of procedures. It's a clear sign that the intense national debates over gender-affirming care are directly impacting the benefits available to the federal workforce and their families. It will make accessing specific types of medical care much harder for some individuals.
So one area of coverage expanding due to clinical trends, another potentially contracting due to political and legal pressures. That really underscores the need to read the fine print.
Absolutely. Plans are also reportedly focusing more on tools and funding for opioid abuse treatment and mental health services, which are ongoing priorities.
Now the practical question, with the shutdown ongoing, how can furloughed employees, who probably can't access their work computers or agency intranet portals, actually make changes to their FEHB plans during open season?
OPM has stated that changes can still be made, even during a shutdown. But the access issue is real for furloughed staff. The strong advice from benefits experts is to use a low-tech backup method, meaning go to the main OPM website, opm.gov, which should still be accessible. Download the standard paper form for health benefits enrollment. That's the standard form 2809. Fill it out completely with your desired plan changes for 2026. sign it, and physically mail it to your agency's HR office.
Create a paper trail just in case.
Exactly. It ensures there's a record of your election submitted before the open season deadline, which is December 8th this year. Hopefully the shutdown ends before then and the electronic systems come back online, but this provides a crucial safety net if it doesn't.
And for retirees, the advice remains consistent.
Pretty much. The key message for retirees is generally not to cancel FEHB coverage outright, because getting back in later is extremely difficult or impossible. Suspension is possible only under very specific circumstances, like enrolling in TRICARE, military health, or certain Medicare Advantage plans, and requires specific procedures. Canceling is usually irreversible.
Okay. We have covered a tremendous amount of ground here. An absolute whirlwind of activity and paralysis. The executive branch sprinting, Congress managing decline, the judiciary rewriting the rules, and the workforce caught in the middle. Let's try to pull these threads together now. What's the main takeaway from this deep dive into these critical 48 hours?
I think the most important conclusion isn't just the sum of the individual actions, but how they starkly reveal these completely disconnected realities coexisting in Washington right now. Our analysis points to three distinct divergent tracks.
Okay, what's the first reality?
First, you have the executive branch's past reality. They were operating as if the old rules still applied. They rushed out those massive midnight regulations, the EPA, PFAS rule, the HHS AI rule, believing they were using established legal deference, Chevron, to cement a lasting policy legacy. That reality, based on Clow, is now legally obsolete. Their actions were built on sand.
Okay, the obsolete past, what's the second reality?
Second is the legislative branch's present reality. Congress is stuck in tactical survival mode. They managed just enough cooperation to pass that clean CR, the funding patch, why, to de-escalate the immediate shutdown threat and protect their own political hides right before the election. But on every substantive policy issue, they remain deeply strategically paralyzed. They're essentially just treading water, governing quarter to quarter.
Calculated survival and paralysis.
Got it.
And the third reality.
The third, and arguably now the most dominant, is the judicial branch's future reality. With the Clow v. Interior decision, the Supreme Court fundamentally altered the balance of power. By imposing that strict major questions doctrine, the judiciary effectively checkmated the executive's regulatory ambitions overnight. They established a new framework where only explicit congressional action can support major new rules. The judiciary has seized control of the future of regulation.
So all those ambitious rules the executive pushed out, PFAS, AI in medicine, maybe even the drone corridors, they're all now heading straight into legal challenges, where the presumption is they are invalid under this new Clow standard. The whole effort might have been futile from the start.
That's the strong probability, yes. Our forward outlook seems pretty inescapable based on this analysis. The immediate future of U.S. policy, at least major new policy, won't be decided by the election results on November 4th or by congressional action in the near term. It's going to be dictated by litigation, a massive litigation vortex.
Where every significant new rule, and maybe even some older ones, gets challenged under Clow.
Exactly. Any rule with major economic impact that can't point to that unmistakable authorization from a Congress that we know is deeply fractured and unlikely to provide such clarity, well, that rule is now, by decree of the highest court, presumptively dead in the water.
What really strikes me in synthesizing all this is the sheer scale of the power shift we've just witnessed, seemingly confirmed on November 4th. It feels like a profound and maybe permanent transfer of functional governing power.
From where to where?
From the executive branch, which is political, moves relatively quickly, and is accountable to voters every 4 years, to the judicial branch, which is appointed, moves much more slowly, is insulated from direct political accountability, and its members serve for life.
That's a stark but accurate assessment of the Clow effect. The judiciary has effectively inserted itself as the primary gatekeeper for any significant policy change that Congress itself doesn't explicitly micromanage through legislation.
Which leads us to, I suppose, the final provocative thought for our listeners to chew on. We've just seen the judiciary dramatically constrain the other two branches, effectively seizing the reins on major policy by creating a kind of legal stasis. So the question becomes, what does it actually mean for the health and structure of American democracy when the real power to make, or perhaps more accurately, to block major policy shifts almost entirely from the elected political branches to the unelected, unaccountable court docket?
How long can policy outcomes be so fundamentally divorced from politics, from the will of the people expressed through elections, before the legitimacy of the entire system starts to fray, or maybe even break entirely? That's the unsettling question Clow leaves us with.